Bix Beiderbecke is our subject today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Brendan Wolf is here to talk about his book on Bix Beiderbecke. And then, of course, Garrison Keillor to talk about the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Well, Brendan, welcome to Scribble.
Thanks for having me.
And we have some interesting, well, I don't know if the questions are interesting, but I'm sure your answers will be.
I'll try.
What concerns you about this book?
I'm not concerned about it. I'm intrigued by the title, particularly the subtitle, The Life and Afterlife of Bix Beiderbecke. What's the difference?
Oh, I think there's a big difference. I think the life of Bix, it lasted from 1903 to 1931. It wasn't, as lives go, particularly interesting or eventful, aside from the fact that Bix Beiderbecke was a genius of American music. The life of a musician in those days was just a lot of recording and traveling. The afterlife of Bix Beiderbecke, after he died, he became one of the great legendary figures of jazz and even in all of American culture. And I think that the form that that legend took was often distinct from the life of the man.
I heard you last August when you were here for the Bix Fest on Paula Sands Live, and I was intrigued by your explanation for his drinking, almost as if the life and afterlife were together in the same person. I think you said to Paula Sands Live that the drinking was sort of his attempt to be just a normal guy, almost troubled by the fact that he had a creative streak that he couldn't handle.
Yeah, I think some of that comes from comments made in the book by a wonderful jazz pianist and Bix fan named Brad Kay. And what Brad talks about with regards to Bix is the way in which he was just completely consumed by the music and his own creativity, to the point where he had difficulty functioning as a normal human being. You know, if you walk around just completely consumed by something, it can cause problems. And that drinking was a way to sort of tamp down that creative excitement just enough that he could kind of function.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I've heard that explanation from other people trying to explain why so many jazz musicians and others become involved in alcohol and drugs and so on. It's an attempt to slow things down. I don't know if that's valid or if they do it just because everybody else is doing it, but especially since drugs have come in so strongly, they have really wrecked so many great creative lives. And I guess Bix will always be remembered as a guy who was done in by alcohol.
Yeah.
But you suggest maybe he was done in equally by this consuming possession of music.
Possibly. I mean, I think that that's a somewhat romantic way of looking at it, but
we look at him romantically all the time.
but I think you might be onto something there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the music just took over, and the phrase that Brad uses in the book is drinking to stay sober, and it suggests that that kind of a creative ecstasy almost. It was like a little bit like being drunk, maybe, and you drink as a way of kind of coming down off of that.
Why has it taken so long to write a thorough, sort of accurate biography of Bix? There have been a lot of stories about Bix, but they certainly haven't gone into it as much as you've gone into it.
Well, I would respectfully disagree a little bit with that. I think that in 1974, Richard Sudhalter and Philip Evans wrote what many consider, and I think rightfully, to be a definitive biography of Bix, Bix Man and Legend. And it doesn't have everything in there, but it is a very thorough, well-written biography with Sudhalter was a musician himself, and so there's great musical analysis in that book. Then in the early aughts, a Frenchman named Jean-Pierre Lyon published a book in France. It was translated into English that updated the Bix biography a little bit. And so with my book, it's less about a ton of new research or sort of telling the true story for the first time than it is about kind of thinking about all the different ways that Bix has been written about and all the different stories that have been told about him and kind of sifting through and figuring out what's accurate, what's not, but also just what do they mean and why do people argue so fiercely about Bix even now?
Aside from those previous books and articles, where did you get your material?
Well, I spent a lot of time reading, but then I also spent a lot of time talking to people. So I talked to Richard Sudhalter early on. In fact, he was the first interview I did back in March 2003. And I remember living in Iowa City and reading a wonderful essay about Bix in Commentary magazine, and it was written by a critic and writer named Terry Teachout. And so I emailed him and said, can I come talk to you about Bix? And so I traveled out to New York and talked to Terry about Bix Beiderbecke. And he said some really interesting, really provocative things, especially about Bix and race. And he talked about Amiri Baraka and took issue with some of the things that that famous critic and poet and playwright had said about Bix. And so then I went, took me a few years, but I went and found Amiri Baraka and talked to him about Bix. And so part of the journey of the book is just talking to all kinds of different people.
Well, is it an argument? Would you just call your book a collection of arguments about Bix?
To some extent. And in fact, an early draft was kind of organized that way. So there would be a chapter about Bix and Davenport and how he fits into this community. There was a chapter about Bix and alcohol, a chapter about Bix and sexuality and Bix and commerce. But in the end, I organize it differently, but those are all still there as ways of thinking about and arguing about Bix.
Why did it take you 13 years? And are you sure you shouldn't have gone on further?
You're never sure when you write a book that you're done. And there are lots of things that you wish you could tweak afterward. But it took me 13 years, in part because I'm slow. I'm slow in sort of figuring things out and thinking them through. It took me 13 years in part because I have a day job, I have a daughter, and I've moved around a lot, and the book doesn't always come first.
Well, what heresy is this?
A couple of publishing questions. How did the book get published?
Well, that is a long and winding tale because I had originally sold it back in 2009 to an imprint based in Colorado of a New York publisher. And they had just published a wonderful book by the music historian Ted Gioia called The Birth and Death of the Cool. And he had a whole chapter on Bix Beiderbecke as a progenitor of this cultural archetype of the cool cat. Mm-hmm. And so I sold the book to this publisher, and I was finishing it and waiting for my advance to come. And the advance never came, so I never gave them the book. And then pretty soon they stopped answering my phone calls and my emails and my agent's phone calls and my agent's emails. And it turns out that the imprint had been shut down. All the editors were let go and all the contracts canceled. So I was fairly disappointed by that turn of events. And I knew that the book needed to be revised. But at that point, that book and I were like in a bad relationship. And so I just sort of stepped away and got some distance from it for a few years, and then took it out again and was able to revise it fairly quickly with some help from an editor friend of mine, and got it into shape and sent it to the University of Iowa Press, who I had talked to way early in the process. And it turns out that the director of the University of Iowa Press is a friend of a friend of mine in Virginia. And when I contacted him, he said, well, I'd just been listening to Bix Beiderbecke. I'd love to learn more. And so it just worked out.
So it was published by the University of Iowa.
That's right.
And university presses serve a very useful purpose, don't they, Roald?
Yes.
Yeah, it's I think I've seen more interesting books come from university presses in these days than I ever have. They're becoming, I don't know, they're becoming more aggressive? Or what exactly is going on?
Well, they're becoming fairly inventive. A former student of mine just had a book published by the University of Chicago Press on the history of outhouses in Chicago. So I guess anything. Brendan, I heard you mention that magic word agent. You do have an agent?
No, I did have an agent.
About half the people listening to this want to know how you went about getting an agent.
Well, it's going to be a disappointing story in terms of people who are looking for advice on how to get it. I actually sold my book without an agent.
Okay.
And then wondered whether I wanted an agent to negotiate a contract. I don't know anything about that stuff and didn't really feel like learning. But I took advice on all kinds of – from all kinds of people. And a friend of mine who's a successful author and had a great agent, she just – called up his agent, and he gave the project to a young agent working in his office who needed, you know, something to work on. And so I got the agent without really even trying. And then she negotiated the contract. But then when the contract was canceled, that was kind of it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, you don't need an agent to hook up with the university press, and now she's only working with like six-figure books and stuff. So,
you also got a super interesting review in the Wall Street Journal book section. That happens, I just happened to read, in about 1% of all the published books.
Oh, wow.
How did that happen?
I have no idea, quite honestly. I was at home on a Friday night watching bad TV on my computer, and periodically I'll Google my name in the book just to see if something new pops up. And I saw the Wall Street Journal review, and then I had to subscribe so I could read it. And it was great, but I'm sure that the press just sent them a book, but there was
You are Mr. Serendipity.
Well, you know, there was a time when I was reviewing books, and the people would send books. They'd send more books than I could possibly review.
Right.
And how you select something to – and that time it was a radio program – and how it would select one to talk about or even to read, because when you suddenly get a stack of books, you think, wait a minute, I don't know that I want to spend the rest of my life reading these books, and they just keep coming.
Yeah, I think that you're really fortunate if you get reviewed as a writer – I was reviewed in the Wall Street Journal, and I was in the New York Times as well. And it's just a huge honor, but it really is says more about your luck than maybe the absolute quality of your book. I remember an academic at the University of Virginia who'd written a wonderful book of history, and a big publisher, much bigger than mine. And he told me he did not get reviewed by one newspaper anywhere in the country. And I really felt for him, but I also talked to him about how I've been a book review editor myself. I was a book review editor at the Concord Monitor in New Hampshire. And like you say, you get a ton of books, and it's kind of just what mood you're in, what you feel like reading, what you feel like writing about, what sort of is in the zeitgeist at that moment, what people are talking about. You just don't have a ton of space. And so if you don't review a book, it really doesn't say much at all about whether that book is deserving.
Yeah, well, I started out reviewing classical records back in the day when they were a big segment of the industry. And I faithfully sent in tear sheets of all my reviews. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I got any record I wanted. And I discovered then that the famous reviewers seldom bothered to send tear sheets, and that my file with these albums was probably thicker than anybody's, although I don't know how many people are reading my reviews in the Davenport Catholic Messenger.
Oh, it's great to get those books and CDs and whatnot in the mail, but I remember those days.
Oh, yeah. That was a palmy time, I'll tell you. Yes. This station was stocked with albums that I got as a record reviewer. But have you had the last thing you want to say about Bix?
In the book?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I don't think – it may be the last thing I say about Bix, but it's by no means the last thing that anyone should say about Bix. It's just Bix, just by nature of who he was and the way his legend has operated over the years, is a kind of bottomless well. There's lots of questions left unanswered, and a few of them over time may even be answered.
Well, you've done a very good job of bringing together a lot of different threads here. And the book is Finding Bix? Are you sure?
Think of it ironically.
Okay. Brendan Wolfe, thank you very much for spending time with us. It's an interesting subject and one of great interest to everyone in this region. And right now, here's another interesting fellow who's going to tell us about the Writer's Almanac. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. It's very interesting talking to Brendan about finding Bix and the negative reaction he stirs in some people. He talks about the fleshly Bix and the spectral
right.
Bix, the real Bix and the legendary one. But there's always a danger when you do that. There's a book out about Brett Favre called Gunslinger, which is a biography without warts. Now, Brett Favre could throw the football harder, faster than almost anybody. And as a result, he became an icon, one of the most popular people. And the fact that he played like a boy endeared him to folks. But writing a straightforward biography, he was a drunk, he was a drug addict, he was a womanizer. A lot of very unappealing things about Brett Favre that people would just as soon not know. And I think it takes a certain kind of daring to dig into things like that. You don't want to mess with icons, because even anything that slightly varies from, you know, that tarnishes the halo that people put around a person because of a certain ability, they just don't want to hear that.
Well, You know, I was thinking, noticing some of the negative comments that Wolf has gotten from locals about, you know, he's messing with our Bix. The same thing is true of Buffalo Bill. Try to tell the true story of Buffalo Bill, the great Western hero. And, you know, E.E. Cummings has a great poem, a little poem about Buffalo Bill, in which he says, Buffalo Bill's defunct.
Defunct, yeah.
Instead of dead, because he never was alive, right? Essentially, Buffalo Bill, for much of his life, was a sham. He's an invention of the dime novel. And by the end of his life, sadly, came to account things that he did that were straight out of the dime novel that he himself had never done. For example, in his Wild West show, he did have a true hero in the Wild West show, Annie Oakley. She could shoot nickels out of the air. But Buffalo Bill's great scene was when he rode into the tent where the show was being on his white horse, and an assistant shot clay pigeons into the air, five of them, because a six shooter can shoot five shots. And one by one, Buffalo Bill would pick out his pistol and shoot them out of the air. He had buckshot in the pistol, right? Hard to miss.
Yeah.
But there are people that don't want to hear that.
That's true. They don't want to hear anything negative. And if you bring up factual material that contradicts the legend, people become very angry. They don't want to hear this. They don't want to hear anything but the what they admire about this person. And so that puts a biographer in a bind. Am I going to tell the whole truth, a partial truth? Am I going to write something celebrating this person for their maybe one outstanding characteristic, or am I going to show the whole person?
The review that Wolf's book got in the Wall Street Journal, it was a great review, and it went on and on about that very problem. You know, how do you tell the truth to people that don't want it? It doesn't fit into the legend.
Yeah, and I don't know that that's it takes. Well, you know, if you've been in the public eye as I have all your life, one of the first things you have to get used to is some really negative things. And sometimes people say and write things about you, and you think, wait a minute, where did that come from? I don't remember anything like that in my life or what I've done.
On the other hand, Don, you can carry that negativity too far. I went to graduate school at the University of Chicago, and I had Walter Blair, who was the great authority on Huck Finn. And Mark Twain, when I went to grad school, was one of the great American novelists. And then all of a sudden you get these debunkers, you know, the sad fate of Mark Twain and proving that he was just a jerk and he was just a hack writer and stuff. They went all overboard in the completely opposite direction.
Yeah, well, that sort of happens. It sort of happens. We're pretty much out of time today, but it's been an interesting discussion with Brendan Wolfe. And we'll have another one next week. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week for the next edition of Scribble.